Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back, everyone, to Your Cases on Hold. This is the March 1st issue of JBJS. We are happy to have you back and hope you're looking forward to the best and brightest in research this month for the first issue of March. I am Andrew Schoenfeld, Deputy Editor for Methods at the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and a man with a particular set of skills. And my co-host,
Antonia Chen, Deputy Editor of Adult Reconstruction, a woman without any sets of skills.
That's not true. In any case, a couple sets of reminders and rejoinders here for everyone. First off, it's March next week. Antonia and I will be at the JBJS booth in the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. So big ding and thumbs up for that. And come. If you are at the meeting, come check out the booth. Come see us. Meet and greet. Exactly.
Yep. We look forward to seeing you guys there.
And so with that, in addition, we have this opinions are our own here for the Your Cases on Hold podcast. Do not reflect the Board of Trustees, the editorial board, or the constituent editors of JBJS or the other journals in the JBJS family. The takes are hot, sometimes intentionally so. So take everything with a grain of salt. Check it out for yourself. Go on jbjs.org. There are wonderful new video collections and video summaries from all the videos that the community has been uploading over the years associated with essential surgical techniques and author interviews. These are now being collated. So that's a work in progress, but should be available. So definitely check that out. In addition, like and subscribe for us here so that you get all the updates, all the ding notifications for every issue of Your Cases on Hold that drops, and give us a 5-star rating at Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. That helps us out. It helps the journal out and allows us to continue to bring these great Easter eggs. And this is going to be an Easter egg extravaganza. So buckle up and stay tuned. The final thing is that this is brought to you by the Miller Review Course. And it is testing season. It is studying season. And if you are planning on taking the part one of the ABOS, or just want to get a refresher, or just want to spend some time in the Overlook Hotel in Sidewinder, Colorado, definitely sign up for the Miller Review Course. That's going to bring us into the top of the pile. I love the first article. JBJS podcasts and what's important series fit more into your fast-paced life and then slow down. By our editor-in-chief, Dr. Mark Swinkowski. It's permanently free, so you can read this anytime you want and maybe read it multiple times. But definitely emphasis on the JBJS podcasts.
And read it over and over again, because we do fit into your hopefully fast-paced life as you're on the go.
That's for sure.
Until your case is on hold.
That's what we tell you on the leaderboard. That's what we tell you on the headline. Next is Current Concepts Review and Lateral Patellar Instability by Drapos Goralski and colleagues. And then What's Important? Reflections from the 2022 Society of Military Orthopedic Surgeons, E. Anthony Rankin Scholars by Ojo and colleagues. That's permanently free. Then What's Important? The Gothic and the Grotesque, Romanticizing Deformity in Verdi's Rigoletto by Moses, also permanently free. Dr. Chen, you consort with anesthesia. Consort? Consort. What do you mean by consort? By consort, do you mean to make us minstrels? And by making minstrels of us, look to hear nothing but discord? Here's my fiddlestick. Here's that she'll make you dance. Zounds, consort. That's adapted Shakespeare. And not Rigoletto, but I think pertinent. Pertinent in this context for sure. And then we have The Role of the Subacromial Bursa in Rotator Cuff Healing, Friend or Foe by Marshall and colleagues. And that's going to wrap it up for top of the pile for this issue. We're going to move into the headlines. Mine is Catastrophic Health Expenditure in Patients with Lower Extremity Orthopedic Trauma by Law and Colleagues. There's a visual summary for this, and it is 30 days free. This was a very interesting study, brings up a very important topic, that of catastrophic health expenditure. And I would encourage people to check this out for the reason that it touches on a lot of the landscape in health policy when it comes to payments and again, this concept of catastrophic health expenditures in a pretty broad way. Obviously, many individuals who sustain traumatic orthopedic injuries are, by the nature of the injuries, not expecting to need a surgery. And therefore, you know, if you need a total knee or you need a spine surgery or something like that, and the finances aren't exactly right, you know, not that you should have to do that, but many do, you know, put it off or save or whatever it may be in the context of their of the way they plan to pay for the intervention. But obviously, you can't do that with orthopedic trauma because the nature of it is it's unexpected. And so individuals who sustain these types of injuries, unfortunately, oftentimes can end up with a very large bill. And I think the authors do a very nice approach to highlight these concerns and to give a broad overview in the introduction and the landscape on the state of this in America today, if you will. They based their assessments on their level one trauma center over 3 years and looked at total hospital charges, which is not the best approximation because it's charges. It's not, it certainly isn't like the costs. And a lot of time hospital charges have a certain inflation factor built into them. There's a lot of peculiarities around. It's like the sticker price on the car or the suggested retail price on certain things. That's not, you know, necessarily what you're going to pay for when, you know, it's time for your kids to go to college. And it's like, you know, the first year of tuition is this, but, you know, then you go on the college tour and they're like, no one actually pays like what say it's like the first year of tuition. So it's total charges, which is an approximation in and of itself. Obviously, you know, for concerns around privacy, et cetera, they're not getting the actual income of these individuals. They're looking to their zip code to determine sort of an estimate of what their annual income would be. And then they engaged in a number of good practices around ways to model this. But at the end of the day, it is a model. And as you've probably heard us say before, all models are wrong, but some are useful. And, you know, I think that really is the case here. So no matter what, there's going to be a certain amount of error factored into their estimations. And that's going to be based on the fact that this is a single center. It's only a lower extremity fracture surgery, so lower extremity trauma. And then, you know, these assumptions that they have to make in determining annual income and some other assumptions that are even a little bit more of a challenge from a method standpoint. The first being that, you know, they consider no insurance or self-pay, private insurance, Medicare, and then Medicaid. So they have here in the methods, Medicaid prohibits patient cost sharing for emergency care and limits total out-of-pocket costs to less than 5% of the household income. Therefore, expenditures were set to zero for patients with Medicare coverage. So at the end of the day, as it turns out, no patients with Medicaid actually have catastrophic healthcare expenditures according to this study. And as we've learned in the past, and I'll quote a tautology of from previous times, nothing is never and nothing is always. So you can't say that if you have Medicaid, there's no one ever experiences a catastrophic health expenditure. In addition, you know, this is really related to like the index hospitalization and just the hospital costs. Like if they needed other things outside, you know, they had to engage in home renovations so that their home could be handicapped accessible, for example, or wheelchair accessible. That's not something that would be factored into this. So, you know, the talking points of the discussion do sort of trend into that Jackie Childs territory, the Jackie Childs paradigm, which is their main talking point is like health insurance expansion and particularly Medicaid expansion. But the way that they handled Medicaid is an artificial construct. So what we're seeing here in their determinations is that this is highly an artifact of the way they handled Medicaid. It's not an epistemological truth. And that is a big concern. So the first thing is that not all patients in the self-pay category would actually qualify for Medicaid. Second of all, you have 35% of patients with private insurance and 2% of patients with Medicare who are experiencing catastrophic health expenditures according to their estimations. So if you just move the 35% of patients with private insurance to Medicaid, does that mean then that no one's good? We could, if everyone was just on Medicaid, there would be no catastrophic health expenditure. That's the conclusion if you just go off of, if you just take it at face value for the results that they're presenting. And, you know, I think all our listeners would inherently understand that that's not a viable health policy initiative. So, you know, the overall, a lot of positives here. It's an interesting study. Some of their estimates are incredibly broad, such as the patients with self-pay as compared to private insurance. It's like the odds of catastrophic health expenditure are 108, essentially, with a confidence interval of 37 to 312. That's incredibly imprecise. And again, it just speaks to, while seemingly a lot of patients at 2,535, there still is components of restricted clinical variation and truncation. Some of that baked into the way they had to model both how they're estimating income, parameters associated with the individuals who would be in the self-pay or no insurance category, and again, how they're handling Medicaid, which automatically gives it sort of preferential treatment in the model. And I don't think is necessarily reflective of what can be actuated in American health policy and also truly is representative of the experience of individuals, even with this insurance. Again, nothing is never, nothing is always. To say it's 0%, it could be 0% for your model, but maybe, you know, you could bootstrap, you could do 95% confidence interval because it's not always going to be zero. So that part is, it's Dr. Fenster saying, you're like, I thought you said that we were going to get two rooms. We would flip the case. And he's like, I said I'm going to flip you for real by putting your case on hold.
You've been flipped.
Yeah.
You've been flipped.
All right. We're looking for patient McManus.
And where'd you find him?
With Dr. Fenster. The art line came out.
Oh, it's hard. So, well, thank you for that one. I'm going to switch to a different topic for the next one. I'm going to talk about perioperative essential amino acid supplementation facilitates quadriceps muscle strength and volume recovery after total knee arthroplasty, a double-blinded randomized controlled trial by Uema et al. Looks like it's our colleagues from Japan. So it's very nice to see double-blinded randomized controlled trial. It's free for 30 days and there's a commentary. So again, don't have to listen to me talk. But what's interesting here is the study that evaluated the impact of essential amino acids on muscle volume and strength after primary total knee arthroplasty. Now, the title just says quadriceps muscle, but they did look at the rectus femoris. So they said previous studies demonstrated less lower limb muscle atrophy and increased functional improvement if you do take these essential amino acids. So they wanted to compare patients who took this essential amino acids, and there's a whole list of them in the article. And you know, there's stuff in there that, you know, probably is good for us on a daily basis to take, but we don't always take them. This product was apparently defined for making sure that people actually, you know, have good recovery after surgery. That's what it's being marketed for. It's preventing perioperative undernutrition. It's got threonine, lysine, isoleucine, valine, methionine, tryptophan, phenylalanine, leucine, histidine. The list goes on.
Is also in my shake right here that I take to help me with your case on hold podcast.
Not a shake weight, a shake. This is a good thing. There is a difference. So there you go. You're a walking, living example of how your muscles are not going to atrophy while we're sitting here. Especially as we're sitting here recording this, you know, we're not doing any activity. So this is important. Good work. So these patients got
the sacrifices we make for JBJS.
We love you guys. So essential amino acid, 3 grams, 3 times a day. And then the placebo group got a lactose powder that was 3 grams, 3 times a day. So they got the same volume and they both got powder. So that was nice that they had a placebo control group. They did a power analysis that said they needed a 15% difference in their primary outcome measure, but didn't actually really say what their primary outcome measure was. They stated they were looking at muscle volume and strength, but they looked at both quadriceps and rectus femoris. So I don't know what that 15% difference really was based on, but they said they needed they had 52 patients, and they had 52 patients at the end of the day with 26 in the essential amino acid group and 26 in the powdered lactose group. They took this supplement 1 week before surgery and 2 weeks after surgery. So it is good they have a placebo trial. They had a long duration of follow-up. They followed them up for 2 years, which is not always the case for these type of studies. So that's nice to see long-term, say, muscle recovery or functional recovery. It was a unique study that's going to be really hard to replicate really anywhere else because patients were brought to the hospital a few days before surgery and stayed for 4 weeks after total knee arthroplasty. If I kept my patient in the hospital for 4 weeks after a primary total knee arthroplasty, I think I'd be fired. So that was something that was interesting, but it did ensure that the patients took the nutritional supplements. So, you know, you give them to them, and you watch them eat it, and they eat 3 meals a day, and they made sure they could get it. So compliance is often a problem that patients don't do these sort of things before surgery or after surgery. But in this case, they could ensure compliance because someone was there to enforce it. So they evaluated the rectus femoris muscle using ultrasonography. The quadriceps muscle were measured isometrically, used a handheld dynamometer for strength, and they measured the diameter of the quadriceps. And they wanted to make sure that they were, you know, measuring it correctly, because actually with ultrasound, it depends where you are. They looked at the rectus femoris muscle, a 4 week interval, but they measured the quadriceps muscle in a 2 week interval. Not quite sure they were different time intervals, but they did have different time intervals for assessment. But then they said they measured everyone preoperatively at 1 week, and then 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks, 6 months, 1 year, and 2 years. So they did state that there were some sort of regular measurements, but at the same time, they said they would remeasure these at different intervals. They did do other assessments, knee pain, knee range of motion, 6 meter walk time, grip strength. So it was interesting that they're looking at the rectus femoris and they're looking at the quads, but they also included grip strength, obviously upper extremity, which, you know, we don't pay attention to. It's always about the lower extremity. Functional mobility, it's that they're walking with independently with a cane, with a walker, a wheelchair, a knee society score. And they did control for baseline muscle strength because that's obviously a difference, right? Not everyone has the same muscle strength going into surgery, so you need to control for that. They do report the raw numbers in tables 1 and tables 2. And table 3 gives you kind of like the functional difference from baseline set as 100%, and if they went up from that and went down from that. So they do account for baseline muscle strength. Interestingly enough, they found that the functional, the rectus femoris muscle, it was larger in patients who received the essential amino acid. The quadriceps muscle strength was greater, and the volume was greater for the quadriceps muscle strength in those who received the essential amino acids. Now, they did record serum albumin levels, and I was surprised why they only did it at baseline. I wish they had done it baseline and throughout the different assessments, because I'm curious to see if serum albumin made a difference, because we do use that as a marker of malnutrition in our patients. And we've been shown that patients who are malnourished have worse outcomes after surgery. So I'm curious to see if albumin would have been different in these patient populations, especially those receiving these essential amino acids, but they didn't only took it at baseline. The muscle recovery, I'm curious if that would have been different too, if they did a medial parapatellar approach in this study, but would it be different if it was a mid-vastus approach versus a sub-vastus approach? So, you know, this is one surgeon, one center, you know, it was good to keep it consistent between patient populations, but that would be something to look into. But the take-home message for this is, okay, essential amino acids make a difference in these muscle volumes, similar to your shake, your rectus femoris, your quadriceps are great, but the clinical outcomes made no difference. And it made no difference across the board, right? And we're talking about all the different ones. We're talking about pain, range of motion, walk time, functional mobility, knee society score. So does it really make a big difference to implement these essential amino acids if you're not going to make any difference in your clinical outcome? Yes, you can brag that your muscles are bigger than someone else's muscles. And, you know, you can be the super person, man or woman, or you know, Superman or Wonder Woman of post-primary total knee arthroplasty with those bulging muscles. But if your functional outcomes are exactly the same, does it really make a difference? And the author stated that perioperative nutritional intervention could contribute to postoperative muscle recovery. I'm not sure recovery is the right term, because recovery was probably pretty similar between groups if you look at the clinical outcomes. But volume and strength, yes, is what it's demonstrated.
Yeah, I mean, that was what I really was remarking on to myself as I was reading this, is kind of, there are some statistical findings, but they don't really seem to be clinically relevant, and which then questions, you know, not that these things are incredibly expensive, but what is the real value of the intervention? It's not improving outcomes. You know, width is a little bit more. The point that you brought up, that then they have this tangential talking point about, well, it could enhance, or it could do this and it could do that. Well, could is hypothetical and theoretical. It's not factual. So yeah, there are lots of things that could, but how many that do? And
fly to the moon, but.
Right. But you may not.
But I may not.
All right. So we're now going into the Your Case is on Hold podcast episode, March 1st, featurette. Conversion to arthroplasty after internal fixation of non-displaced femoral neck fractures. Results from a Swedish register cohort of 5,428 individuals 60 years of age or older by Lagergren and colleagues. There is a commentary, so you don't have to take it from us. This is also permanent free, so definitely check it out for yourself. Very interesting paradigm here, looking at data from the Swedish fracture register. Between 2012 and 2018, the paradigm, as many may be aware, is that, you know, how we treat femoral neck fractures in these days is highly preference sensitive. It definitely follows the concept of preference sensitive variation, which really means that the surgeon you see may have a high proclivity to do one thing or the other in terms of internal fixation for femoral neck fractures, or just replacing it. And this may be colored by their training, their background, their culture, or the environment in which they're working. For example, according to the 2021 annual report of the Australian and New Zealand Hip Fracture Registry, 50% of non-displaced femoral neck fractures are treated with arthroplasty. And then in Sweden, internal fixation is used almost 90% of the time in patients 60 or older. Arthroplasty is only used in select cases. You know, I'm going to bring up the Wakanda registry here. I'm wondering what they're doing with the adamantium total joint replacements.
Never need to replace those. They're irreplaceable.
Well, yeah. Once you do the replacement, there are no revisions, of course. But that's still a concern for us here in the real world. And obviously, if you're doing a replacement, and these individuals have different parameters and performance characteristics than individuals who have the severe arthritis nearing the hip replacement, there's increased risk of dislocation or increased risk of wear and all these factors that have to be considered. So they wanted to look at this in the Swedish Fracture Register. They used a very appropriate competing risk model where they handled the competing risk of mortality as a means to account for the number of individuals still eligible for a revision, we'll say. And the cumulative incidence of conversion to arthroplasty was essentially 6% at 1 year, 8% at 2 years, and 10% at 5 years. And the conversion rates within 2 years were about 7% in 60 to 69-year-olds, 10% in 70 to 79, and then 8% in greater than 80-year-olds. Women had a higher risk of conversion. Mortality was higher in men at all time points. That's probably not a surprise. Their conclusion is that the risk of conversion was highest in women and in patients 70 to 79, and that these findings warrant further research in this, what they call this direct quote, frail patient group. So some things going on hold here. Dr. Fenster's back, and you misunderstood. He didn't mean flip the rooms. He meant that he was going to flip you to red. And so the first thing is that they're talking right here about a frail patient group. Now, frailty is a physiologic state. You don't characterize groups of people as frail unless it's a group of people that are actually physiologically frail. You just don't say 70 to 79-year-olds are frail, because there are many 77 79-year-olds, 80 to 89-year-olds, and even those over 90 who are not physiologically frail. Their appearance is younger than their chronologic age, right? Physiologic age versus chronologic age. That's what we're talking about, frailty. And their limitations say that they actually don't have data on frailty, comorbidities, or cognitive impairment. They also don't have radiographs to show fracture displacement, and the fracture characteristics are probably very limited characterized, if they're characterized at all, you know, in outside of the generic sort of big bucket kind of things. You know, you're not getting good characterization of fracture patterns. So a conclusion should not really state more research should be done. Like that's just a you know, pro tip. That's not the best kind of conclusion. If more research can be done, why were you doing this? You weren't doing this research to understand if more research needed to be done. And more research can always be done, right? Like you can always say, oh, we need more research. We always need more research. There's nothing that puts a definitive answer. We don't ever get to the opening in Plato's cave analogy where you're seeing the light for what it really is. There's always more research that can be done and should be done. So that kind of goes without saying. I think this is an interesting characterization of the Swedish fracture register. There's obviously, you know, some parochial concerns and practice-based concerns. The individuals in Sweden, for whatever reason, are not as into doing hip replacements, I guess, outright, but I don't know how they feel about it doing after the fact and as, you know, essentially a revision for the internal fixation or a secondary surgery after the internal fixation. So that may also color things. So these figures, they're good for Sweden. They may not be good for us here or in other parts, even in the United States or certainly other countries. But, you know, I'm sure these questions come up in clinical care. And, you know, if you do an internal fixation and they say, what is the chance that I'm going to actually need a hip replacement? With those caveats, you could probably, you know, present those numbers. These numbers could also show up. This has the potential for Kaiser Soze. A lot of usual suspects, Easter eggs on today's Dr. Fenster, Fred Fenster comes from the usual suspects, if you didn't catch on to that. And so does McManus.
And so does Kaiser Soze.
The strangest thing, Keaton. So that's where I'm at with this. Some interesting points, you know, reasonable study, but some of the conclusions are going on hold as far as I'm concerned.
I have to second you on that. That's the hardest thing with registry studies, right? You can only take what you see there. There's not radiographs that are associated with it. And why I convert, why someone else converts, why anyone else does something is sometimes a subjective claim that we can't figure out. So until we get more like natural language processings, automated ways to read x-rays and be able to put those into these databases, I agree. There's a little bit of hold here.
Yeah. The register studies invite you out to their Hamptons address and you think it's going to be this resort where you're going to be getting the, you know, Louis Vuitton Supreme slippers to walk around on the beach, but it's really Grey Gardens. This place is falling apart.
At least there's green around, right? That counts for something.
Yeah,
you're like, you're
not if the green is mold.
True. Your bar is low.
Honorable mentions. Efficacy of a modified cocktail for periarticular local infiltration analgesia in total knee arthroplasty, a prospective double-blinded randomized controlled trial by Wong and colleagues. Lactate mediates the bone anabolic effect of high-intensity interval training by inducing osteoblast differentiation by Zhu and colleagues. There's an infographic for this. And then the three-dimensional fatty infiltration in the overall supraspinatus can be predicted by localized sectional accumulation units. A cross-sectional study in patients with atraumatic small to massive rotator cuff tears by Zhu and colleagues, also infographic, also 30 days free. Two basic science studies in the honorable mention for this episode. We're going to leave this episode with a new March Madness challenge. So here's a March Madness challenge for the readership. You can get the answers in the next episode of Your Cases on Hold. If you think you have the answers, send them to us. Find us at the annual meeting. Give us the answers, but here it is. You ready for it? The March Madness Challenge. You know, it's always college related because it's March Madness, right? Get your brackets done. Get your college, you know, support your team or your alma mater or your favorite team, whatever it may be. So We need the names of the 9 American universities that were chartered by the British Crown. So this is pre-1776. Pre-1776 borders we're talking about here. There's 9 universities today chartered by the Crown of England. You call yourself a patriot, loyal subject to the crown. There you go.
Good luck. I've got to do some soul searching and thinking as well, too.
Yeah. I could like give away 2 of them, but just big, but I won't. I'm not giving anything away. You guys come up with it on your own. We'll find it out next time.
Come on back and tune on in for your cases.
Come see us in Las Vegas for real.
See you guys soon.
For real.